we're looking at factors contributing to child abuse in Wisconsin and what to do about it. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There are just shy of 5,000 known cases of child abuse or neglect in Wisconsin each year. That's according to the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health. Educators, how have you dealt with child abuse and neglect in your schools? How has neglect and abuse affected your life or your community? Do you work or volunteer for an organization that works to combat child abuse? What is part of that work? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Sophie Carson is an urgency reporter for the Oshkosh Northwestern and the Fond du Lac Reporter, which are part of USA Today Network Wisconsin. She co-reported the recent piece, Why Are So Many Infants Dying of Abuse? Sophie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
What do we know about the number of children's deaths in Wisconsin where abuse or maltreatment was to blame?
That's a great question. That number is about 27 child deaths per year across all 72 counties. Statewide, we see a statistic that they can compare each county, and that's 33.1 reports of death. 33.1 reports of abuse or neglect per 1,000 children. So that way they can compare each county depending on, you know, not depending on size.
So given state data, what do we know about the reach of violence against children across Wisconsin?
It's definitely a problem. You know, we saw these three kind of serious cases both in Wausau and Oshkosh that we reported on, and it's extensive. The certain counties, you know, do see more of a problem, but it is extensive.
So in your reporting, you cover three infant deaths, one in Wausau and two in Oshkosh, as you said, and report that they share something in common in terms of those incidents, that the households they're in are dangerous for children. What does that mean?
That's a great question. So, you know, what we found was we really wanted to look at the three cases of child abuse that did result in these infants dying. So in Wausau, there was a case of a two-month-old who died at the hand under a babysitter's care. And in Oshkosh, there were two cases of men in that household who had, prosecutors say, shaken or slammed the infant, and the infant died from brain damage. So very, very kind of brutal cases. But we really wanted to look at, you know, why is this happening both in those cases and then extending on to other child abuse cases across the state, because, like you said, those numbers are pretty high. What we found was certain risk factors make children more likely to be victims of abuse. So that means, like you say, they make them more, the households are more dangerous. So certain household environments are more dangerous for children, whether that's you're in a household where a parent is incarcerated, you're in a household with abuse, of substances, any kind of those things. Those are things that will make a child more likely to be, abused. You know, whether it's an infant that dies or just a case that doesn't result in death.
We're looking at the linkages in physical child abuse cases here in Wisconsin with Sophie Carson. She reports for the Oshkosh Northwestern and the Fond du Lac Reporter, which are part of USA Today Network. Sophie, looking a little bit more on these households, what did people you spoke to say about who's most commonly linked to child abuse based on conviction reports?
That's a great question. In general, and we're generalizing here, but the people who are involved in these types of cases are anyone from an unrelated female caregiver to a mother's boyfriend, a child's father. Normally, it's not the biological mother. So that does bring up, you know, one of the things we looked at, which is why good child care is so important. We found that, you know, if you leave a child in the care of a caregiver who's licensed, a caregiver who you trust, that, experts have told us is better than simply a partner or acquaintance. For example, a mother's boyfriend or someone you happen to know. The case in Wausau was a woman who had a record of child abuse and the baby was still being taken care of by this woman. So it's really important that good child care is you know, put forward, despite if someone is low in income.
So a number of these people may feel frustrated with babies who cry inconsolably, which is perhaps pretty normal. Normal infant and toddler behavior can be a catalyst for abuse when caregivers don't know how to deal with it. What's being done in Wisconsin to educate people about normal baby behavior?
That's a great question. You know, we looked at this curriculum called Period of Purple. So it's this curriculum. I have to credit Dr. Lynn Sheets. She's at Children's Hospital. She works closely on the issues of child abuse. And what she found was, you know, these parents might not understand, like you say, why babies are crying so much, and they might be very frustrated. We did see that in the case of Corey D. Lyons of Oshkosh, where his 2-month-old died after prosecutors say he shook the baby repeatedly, being frustrated with the baby's crying. Being able to kind of have this understanding of this crying is normal, even if it's long lasting. You know, this Period of Purple curriculum goes through this. So babies might be crying for a long period of time. They might, you know, resist being able to be soothed. It might be unexpected. So these are the kind of things that new parents need to be connected with in terms of resources. And if you're experiencing some of these risk factors, like we talked about, you're in a household that might be more unstable, you might have more difficult time accessing these resources. And that's what's so key here.
Do we know how this Color Purple curriculum is being taught around the state, or how the message is getting out?
Yeah, hospitals are spreading this curriculum. That's I don't know too much about their curriculum, but that's what I can say on that subject.
You know, in terms of getting this data, is it difficult to get accurate numbers on child abuse? Does the data necessarily reflect the whole picture that we're seeing?
You know, I don't think it does. The cases of, like, infant deaths are very rare in the city of Oshkosh. In Winnebago County, there were 2 cases of homicides of children between 2012 and 2017. And then we saw 2 people charged in December of 2018 with homicides in the city of Oshkosh. So it's uncommon, but there are a lot of difficulties with the numbers, whether that's people who do or don't report cases to Child Protective Services, whether or not those cases are taken are found to be substantiated by Child Protective Services. You know, there's a series of kind of steps that someone has to go through in order for these cases to even be counted. So I do think it's a problem that is underreported.
Sophie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Sophie Carson is an urgency reporter for the Oshkosh Northwestern and the Fond du Lac Reporter, which are part of the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. And she co-reported the recent piece, Why Are So Many Infants Dying of Abuse? Coming up next, an outbreak of measles in Washington state is raising renewed questions about vaccination exemptions. While most states allow exemptions for religious reasons, only 18 states, including Washington and Wisconsin, allow exemptions for philosophical or personal convictions. We hear from a health expert. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We're talking vaccinations and measles cases here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The measles vaccination was developed in the 1960s, and it almost eliminated the highly contagious viral infection. But the World Health Organization released a report last week tracking a surge of measles in parts of the world. And measles outbreaks are popping up around the U.S. More than 50 people now have been infected in an outbreak in Washington State and Oregon. Have you opted for a vaccination exemption for your child? If so, why? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. James Conway is Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison. He's also a pediatric disease specialist. Dr. Conway, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about measles first. In 2018, there were just under 350 individual cases of the disease here in the U.S. and 372 reported cases total. That's second highest number since the disease was eliminated in the U.S. in 2000. So now some global health experts are saying that 2019 could see the highest rates in decades. What's going on here?
Yeah, it's unfortunate that we constantly do have imported cases showing up as people arrive in this country. And so I think people had this false impression that this disease had been eliminated. But in fact, it still circulates worldwide. And then all you need is just a pocket of individuals who have not been vaccinated all in the same place, and outbreaks are waiting to happen.
Who is getting measles, and what do these outbreaks look like here in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's mostly children, mostly unvaccinated children, almost exclusively. We have a couple outbreaks actually happening. There's one in Rockland County, New York. There's one in Washington State. And those continue to spread, and partially because measles is such an interesting virus. It has a relatively long incubation period, and people can be shedding the virus even before they have actual symptoms. And so that makes this sort of the perfect storm for circulation.
Who is most susceptible?
Mostly people that are unimmunized, and especially those that have underlying immunologic conditions. Those people are even more vulnerable, not only to getting sick, but to get particularly sick from the virus.
Some say measles is a relatively harmless childhood illness, especially with today's medical care. Can you talk more specifically about what it is and its potential dangers?
Sure. Well, it starts as a respiratory virus. I mean, that's how it's transmitted, is by people coughing and sneezing near each other. But the problem is that it's a particularly virulent or aggressive virus, and people get pneumonia, and unfortunately, many children in the world die from this virus still, because if you're malnourished on top of everything else, you really don't have the ability to fight this off. And so children die from either pneumonia or from diarrhea.
And there can be rash, there can be inflammation in the lungs and brain, is that right?
Yeah, so it starts out as just a, you know, cough and runny nose type thing, and then the rash starts. It usually starts with a high fever, and then runny nose and cough, and then the rash shows up, and that's when people become aware. But it spreads throughout the entire body, and there's even these unusual sequelae that sometimes happen in people where 7, 10, 15 years later, they can actually have neurologic problems. So it is not a benign virus. The other thing that they're starting to recognize as well is that even if you survive it, it turns out, at least worldwide, that you still have a much higher risk of dying afterwards. And it seems to also do things to the immune system. So it really seems to almost rock the immune system in a way that we don't completely understand at this point.
We're talking about a measles outbreak that's causing us to look more closely at vaccination schedules, vaccination exemptions. Dr. James Conway is our guide. He is Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison. Do you think Wisconsin needs to tighten up its vaccination law, or do you appreciate the room for personal conviction exemptions? Parents who have vaccinated, what do you see as the health consequences here? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Conway, can you give us a bit more of the history on the MMR vaccine that measles, mumps, and rubella, and how you've seen it change over time?
Sure. So the vaccines were all developed individually. And, you know, the idea probably to save children unnecessary suffering, but also for convenience, was eventually to start bundling these vaccines together. And so more and more vaccines are combined together to minimize the number of shots, but also to maximize the opportunities for people to make sure that they're fully immunized. And so we've been pretty much using just the combined measles, mumps, rubella vaccine here exclusively in the United States now for some decades. In some areas of the world, they still use either a measles monovalent vaccine or just a measles rubella combined vaccine. But once we reached the point where we had, you know, over 80% of kids routinely immunized, we really started to see then that dramatic drop in cases around the United States. And I do think that that's part of why we've gotten ourselves into this situation, is that we're a victim of our own success almost, and that these diseases really become less and less apparent to both the public and even to providers. So making the diagnosis actually gets harder and harder just because fewer and fewer people have seen these diseases.
Does measles require a booster? Do you get revaccinized?
Well, the interesting thing about measles vaccine, some vaccines, you're right, we do give multiple doses to keep boosting the immune system. The measles vaccine is actually very, very good. The problem is that somewhere between 2 and 5% of people don't respond to the first dose. And so we do give most children routinely now a second dose at 4 to 6 years of age. They get their first one right after their first birthday and then a second one at 4 to 6 years. But when we have these outbreaks, sometimes we actually give people even a third dose to make sure that that small group of people that didn't fully respond are fully protected. And so they're doing that now in Rockland County, New York, is giving third doses because that outbreak has been spreading for quite some time.
Does that help? Do we see research saying that an additional dose will help?
Yeah, it helps at least from a population society standpoint because it essentially starts to eliminate those outliers who have not responded. And it really gives you this broad herd immunity that you need to keep these things from continuing to spread on and on and on.
Well, let's talk now about vaccination exemptions. All states require immunizations for children to attend school, but allow for medical exemptions. 47 states also allow parents to opt out of vaccines for religious reasons, and 17 states, including Wisconsin, allow parents to opt out of vaccines if they have a philosophical or personal conviction against immunizations. So let's look at that last one. Why do we have this in place, personal conviction?
Yeah, this was originally designed for people that had such deeply held beliefs that were almost on the equivalence of a religious belief, that the thought was to permit people that had such a strongly held belief. And the idea was that there would probably be relatively few of these people. I think it's become something that's almost then a convenience for people either that have difficulty managing and coordinating their schedules to get all the vaccines, because it is, you know, a lot of visits and a lot of doses. But it also has led to this kind of slippery slope of people just thinking that it's unnecessary for their kid and that they've gotten away with it for many years because everybody else has been vaccinating. And so, you know, you can become a victim of your success in many ways. And so as long as everybody else is covering their kids and doing their vaccinations, it's much less likely your kid will be coming into contact with any of these diseases. But unfortunately, what happens is the folks that are starting to make these philosophical decisions tend to cluster in areas. And so that's what's happened in Washington State. Dane County is another area that actually has relatively high concentrations of people who have opted out of vaccinating their children.
How easy or difficult is it to get an exemption like this?
It's pretty easy in Wisconsin. I mean, basically, it's a form that people can print out or be provided by the school that they fill out and just hand to the school nurse. Some states have tried to make them a little bit more challenging. Washington State actually had put into place something where there had to be some medical provider who co-signed it and said, yes, we've had a conversation about this and there's been some training. Texas actually put in an unusual stab at this where they actually required people to have it notarized just as another step to make sure that people were absolutely serious about doing these things. And so that's one of the ideas that people have started to talk about is there some way we should make it a little bit more difficult to do just to make sure people really understand exactly what it is they're doing?
What are pediatricians talking to their families about when an exemption comes into the conversation at that visit with a pediatrician? How do they broach it?
Yeah, the American Academy of Pediatrics and a number of other groups actually developed forms to try to guide a conversation, which basically led to trying to make people have at least a balanced view and understand that making a decision not to vaccinate their child was a conscious decision to leave their child vulnerable to a disease that could disable or kill them. And I think that early on, when we thought these personal convictions would be relatively unusual, there wasn't really a whole lot of conversation around that. But as they became more and more common, the medical community realized that we had an obligation to actually help our patients and their families really understand what it is that they're doing. And so the idea is really now to make sure that they're fully aware of what these diseases are like, exactly what the children may suffer through if they have them, and make it a conscious decision that they're really leaving their child vulnerable to one of these dangerous diseases.
What is your take on exemptions for philosophical, personal, or religious reasons?
Well, I mean, I would prefer that people do the right thing and protect their children. And while I do understand that there are some very narrow religious groups that that do think that their children should not be vaccinated. You know, in general, most of the major religions in the world believe vaccines are perfectly appropriate and reasonable. And so I think that these should be a relatively rare thing. I think we could and should in Wisconsin really think about tightening these up and at least making sure that there's a conversation with a medical professional that happens at the time that somebody decides to take one of these waivers.
We're talking about immunization schedules, measles outbreaks with Dr. James Conway as our guide. He's a pediatric disease specialist and associate director of health sciences at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute. Your questions about vaccinations are welcome at 800-642-1234. Have you opted for a vaccination exemption for your child? If so, why? Could anything change your mind? And what questions do you have about vaccinations? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Coming up, we'll look at Wisconsin's laws surrounding vaccination exemptions and how they work. News is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about an influx of measles cases and immunization exemptions here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the State Department of Health Services, a growing number of Wisconsin families are opting out of vaccinations required to attend school by using a personal conviction waiver. And CDC data show that fewer Wisconsin kindergartners are getting some of the required vaccines. Have you opted for a vaccination exemption for your child? If so, why? Pediatricians, how do you talk with your families about personal conviction waivers? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. James Conway stays with us. He's the Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison. Let's go to the phones now with Tyler joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Tyler. What are your thoughts on this?
Hi. My experience is a little bit different from what Dr. Conway was talking about. When my wife and I had our firstborn, we were kind of surprised at how easy they were making it to opt out of vaccinations, kind of making it sound like it was a personal choice. It didn't really seem to matter a whole lot. It was kind of surprising how easy they were making it to, you know, again, opt out.
So what was your reaction to opting out, or what was your decision like, if you would be willing to share that?
Well, our decision was to get a vaccination, but my wife and I were both kind of taken aback by how much of a choice it was. We kind of thought it would have been more of a, you know, something they would not condone, but they would condemn.
You thought there might be a little bit more urgency about you going toward the vaccination route.
Correct. We were surprised that they even gave it as an option.
Tyler, thanks for the call. Dr. Conway, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we had all been lulled into something of a false sense of security when we did have vaccination rates in the 90s that were well into over 90% of kids immunized. I think that many physicians and providers were lulled that these diseases then had become rare enough that it did start to seem like it was something more of a choice. I think we've realized that things really are not as rosy and that these diseases continue to circulate everywhere. And these are really, you know, I think very tragic and unfortunate diseases. I've seen every one of them. I may be one of the few people in this region that's actually seen every disease that we've ever vaccinated against. And watching children suffer with these diseases is just heart-wrenching and really one of those things that if you haven't seen them, I think it does start to get a little bit easy to let people slide. And I think Tyler's experience is kind of interesting and I find very compelling because it is sort of a signal of how deep the problems lay when people get too complacent.
Let's go to Sam now in Eau Claire. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. I'm curious about arguments beyond empirical or philosophical points being made about vaccination and how much things like cost, insurance coverage, the time needed for appointments, things like that, would factor into the decision whether to vaccinate or not vaccinate your child.
Really interesting comment and thought, Sam, and I do want to talk about this for a second. You know, one of the things that's really interesting is that we're one of the few countries that actually has these kinds of school entry mandates. most of the world actually provides vaccines essentially for free to the public as the way of eliminating barriers. United States, we did have for many, many years, people had to make co-pays and things like that and actually pay out of pocket to be vaccinated. And so way back in the Kennedy administration, they actually had to create a program, the Vaccines for Children program, to basically provide vaccines to the poor, because you couldn't really mandate vaccines and be charging people, especially the poor. And so they had to create a way of doing that. That continued to be the system that we functioned under, but there were still a lot of underinsured people. And you're right that the financial burden of that did lead some people in some areas to then have to or need to take the opt-out route just because they did have issues with those kinds of things. The fortunate thing that happened, at least in recent history, was that the Affordable Care Act, with all its faults and glitches, did have some really positive things about public health. And one was that it did make vaccines something that insurers had to cover at essentially a $0 copay and really try to remove that financial barrier. But you're right. I mean, vaccines, we need to do better at making them easier for people to get, and having to take time out of people's busy schedule to schedule appointments and things like that is somewhat challenging. And so we do encourage more providers, including pharmacies and others that can provide vaccines, to be able to give them at off hours when people don't need to then take time off of school and work to be able to get those vaccines.
What do we know about the vaccination rate here in Wisconsin?
So the vaccination rates are it depends on how you calibrate them. We have an entire schedule we call the 43133, which is basically how many doses of each vaccine we give. Most areas of the country, including Wisconsin, somewhere between 70 and 75% of kids have had all of those vaccines on schedule. However, you know, those kids are not all or nothing. And so it's usually the kids are missing one or two doses. So for most of our vaccines, we hang around somewhere between 85 and 92% or so. The goal for most vaccination programs is when you start to implement a new vaccine, you try to get over 80% immunization coverage. That's when at least the herd immunity stops massive circulation. But the goal is really to get each vaccine over 90%, which is when you've got enough herd immunity. Essentially, what that means is only 1 in 10 people are vulnerable, that it becomes less likely that things circulate widely. And so what we've seen now over the last 10 or so years is more and more people skipping certain vaccines. And so most of our vaccines now in Wisconsin are hanging around 88, almost 90% for some of them. But that's why many of us are nervous that we're kind of an outbreak waiting to happen for a number of diseases. And we've actually experienced that with the mumps outbreaks over the last couple decades, with the whooping cough pertussis outbreaks we've had. All of those, although they burn themselves out eventually, are symptoms of this under-immunized population that we're worried about.
Let's go back to the phones now with Katie joining us from Janesville. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning. I'm one of the families that kind of, picked and choose which vaccines to do. When the kids were little, the only one that I ever opted out of was the chickenpox, and it wasn't real. I would say I didn't have a real problem opting out of it, but it wasn't all that easy either, because the doctor did try to push it. When the kids got to be school age, it depended on which school we were in as to whether we got pushed to try to get it or not. Over the years, I've got four children. Two actually had the chickenpox, and then two titered out. And I got the titers done just so that we could have it in their records, and we stopped getting pushed at to get the vaccine.
So Katie kind of curated which vaccines her kids would get. What about that approach?
Well, that's the way many families go with this. You know, and that's why when we talk about this phenomenon, you know, you'll hear the term anti-vaccine or anti-vaxxers. That's a very, very limited and small group of people. Most people that we deal with are vaccine hesitant. And so most of the approaches that people take are similar to Katie's, where for whatever reason they carve out a certain vaccine, either because they're worried that it's not safe or because they're not convinced that it works as well as it needs to. And it's really variable, both the arguments that people use and which vaccines people choose to opt out of, which is what I find, you know, somewhat fascinating. So, you know, chickenpox is one of those diseases, one of the more recent additions to the vaccine schedule from back in the mid-90s. And as a disease that most of us did go through, at least in certain generations, although it was pretty uncomfortable, as I recall it, and having flashbacks here now. You know, most people survived it, and very few kids died from it. But in fact, you know, about 100 kids a year did die from chickenpox back in the day, which was one of those things that, you know, even physicians across their career would rarely have experienced one of those patients. And so I think people did think about it as a rite of childhood passage. But, you know, as we looked at it, especially the public health costs, the reason schools push chickenpox so much is that anytime there's an outbreak of chickenpox in a school, the investigation and shutting down and deciding which kids need to be excluded gets to be quite a hassle. And, you know, there's a number of publications that have talked about literally millions of dollars that school systems can sometimes get into in having to deal with these outbreaks, which is why they're encouraged to push these kinds of things. So we do find a lot of families like Katie that make whatever decisions they make and then, you know, have to navigate trying to figure it out. I'm kind of encouraged, at least, that her school system and her physician group at least did push and trying to explain to them that it's a gamble to make those kinds of decisions.
Let's go to Tom now in Slinger. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. I would like to encourage your listeners to go to the Children's Health Defense Fund, which will give factual information about vaccines, and also to go to the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, which is a government-run system that's said to be only 1 to 10% of all the reporting adverse events, which shows 93,000 adverse events related to the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine that include 463 deaths. And so far, there have been no deaths related to the measles disease. And also, one other thing I'd like to mention that I'm sure your guest, the doctor, knows, that in an infant, there is no capability of having any antibodies created from a disease in the first 6 months of life.
Well, let's get Dr. Conway to respond to this.
So there's a lot there to unpack. You know, so the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System that Tom mentioned is, in fact, kind of the gold standard for where we look. And, you know, what that system runs by is a passive reporting system. With that said, every medical provider is obliged to report any concern they have about any vaccine. And in fact, it's actually allowed that physicians, families, individuals, lawyers, anybody can report into that. That's the goal of it. And then each of those cases gets investigated, and that database then is built up of confirmed cases of things that actually really were caused by the vaccine versus things that were just associated. So that's always the big issue when you're looking at something that's reported after a vaccine. Was it just an association, or is there causation? And I think that's really where the critical part in the next layer of the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System is really the important part, is the investigation to decide which ones are actually truly attributed to the vaccines.
Talking with Dr. James Conway, he stays with us as we talk vaccinations and whether Wisconsin is prepared for an outbreak of cases of measles like we're seeing in other pockets of the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at immunization trends and reasons why some people don't vaccinate on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The World Health Organization is reporting a surge of measles cases around the world. And in Washington State, where there's an influx of cases, the immunization rate is at 90%. But researchers are saying that it needs to be higher in order to prevent an outbreak. Parents who vaccinated, what do you see as the health consequences here? Are you worried about your own children at school or elsewhere? And pediatricians, how does your immunization talk go with your families? Are there misconceptions? Where do they come from? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. James Conway stays with us. He's an associate director for health sciences at the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison. Dr. Conway, what do we see in terms of vaccinations for adults?
Well, vaccinations for adults is sort of this expanding platform where we've originally been immunizing the elderly and the over 65s, and now we're seeing more and more vaccines come into that space. With, in addition to influenza, the pneumococcal vaccine, and then the shingles vaccines are sort of the latest into that section.
Let's go to Mark in New Berlin with thoughts on that. Mark, hi.
Hi, that's my question, I guess. I'm a senior. I've taken a lot of the vaccines that they've offered for seniors, but not all of them, and I've always considered it to be just my choice. Is there a problem if I don't take a shingles or if I don't take a flu vaccine? Do you see that as a health problem for other people?
Well, it's an interesting question, Mark, because, you know, there really is no mandate for vaccines for older individuals. You know, the idea in children is that schools are the optimal place for diseases to circulate. You know, we put kids in classrooms, we teach them to work and play well with each other and to share, and unfortunately they share organisms fairly regularly. And so the idea of requiring children either to be excluded when they were sick or quarantined, or to be vaccinated to be able to be in school while things circulated, came up in 1950s and throughout the century. And it was even held up to the Supreme Court that the rights of the individual do not supersede the rights of the rest of the population. When you get into adults, especially with the vaccines that we're giving to adults, they really are primarily designed to protect the adult themselves. And so while there may be some secondary benefit if we get enough adults immunized for influenza, for instance, that there's less of it circulating in those populations, it's really more about the individual. And so obviously, because you can't really exclude adults from school because they're not in school, there's really never been a way or a mechanism that's been designed to put more pressure into that particular group. And so that's part of the reason that our adult immunization rates are actually relatively crummy overall. I mean, your group segment of the population and the seniors are actually pretty good about getting your flu vaccines, and many of you have gotten your pneumococcal vaccines. But, you know, the shingles vaccines, only about a third of adults that are eligible have actually gotten those. It doesn't really present an enormous risk to the rest of the population. So it's really individual choice when you're in those kinds of age groups.
We had a call from Marshall who wanted to ask generally about the safety of vaccines and have you address what is in these vaccines.
Sure. So, you know, the safety of vaccines is obviously one of the two critical points. When we think about any vaccines, the two questions that are always asked is it safe and does it work, or what we call efficacy? And there's a lot of research that's done on both sides. And in fact, vaccines are held to a very different standard from most drugs because you are giving them to healthy people with the idea of having them stay healthy. You know, most drugs, you've got a condition you're treating, and so you're giving them drugs to treat that condition, and you're willing to tolerate some side effects. But vaccines are held to a very, very different standard. And there's a lot of vaccines that get developed that never get to the market just because they don't reach that threshold for being considered so safe. And so vaccine safety monitoring, I think people need to recognize, is really the critical piece. And it is an enormous amount of work and effort and money that goes into monitoring for the safety of all of these vaccines. So, you know, the other thing to recognize is the longer a vaccine's been on the market, the longer safety data has been collected. And so for these vaccines that have been around for 40, 50 years, I can guarantee you that there's no way people would continue to use them if they didn't need to and if they weren't considered safe. And our goal is to stop vaccinating. So many of us walk around with a smallpox scar on our arm that are of a certain age. We did get to the point where we immunized widely enough worldwide, we eradicated that disease, and we're eventually able to stop vaccinating. And that's the goal of all vaccines, is get to the point where we just get rid of the disease and we don't have to keep doing this anymore. And so if we all kind of pitch in and get onto the same page, that is still an opportunity that I think many of us see as the goal overall.
Let's look at technology, the internet, social media. A community health physician in Vancouver, Washington said, quote, "It's the Google monster, unfortunately. Once people Google, they find all these warnings and adverse reactions, and it can blur what's really important for the child or even people to get." So is technology misinformation spreading on the internet?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with the internet is that there's no referee. And so there's nobody there either taking down information once it's disproven or sorting through it and trying to decide what's legitimate and what's not. You know, I get it. I mean, I'm not at odds with people that are taking the time to do their own research. I mean, they're doing what we want them to do. We want people to care about their kids and we want them to be well informed. The problem is just not having a sophisticated way to figure out what's really accurate and what isn't. And so I think that the medical community, that's our responsibility. And to be honest, I don't know that we've done a terrific job getting that information conveyed in a way that's digestible and that is at the level and understandability that people need. And so I think that's much of what many of us are doing, is trying to work on clarifying those messages in a way that really gets to the heart of the truth and helps people make the decisions that we think are best for their children and their families.
So on a more local level, what do you think public health officials and physicians, pediatricians here in Wisconsin should be doing to encourage vaccination?
Well, I think we need to continue to make exactly efforts like this, where there are really important episodes like this measles outbreak, and helping people rethink exactly what kind of decisions they've made. I think we need to engage with them rather than to push them away. You know, there was this practice some years ago that if people didn't want to be immunized in your medical practice, you could fire them. And I think that was a catastrophically bad decision, because it just pushes people even further away from having those engaged medical conversations with a trusted medical provider. So I think that, you know, trying to really endorse the whole idea of a medical home, having true relationships with people, I think is really the best way to get both trust and get onto the same page.
Let's look globally here at the World Health Organization. We had the WHO Director General speaking on this issue during World Immunization Week in 2018. Let's listen.
We must fight myth and misinformation with science and evidence, but we must do it in a compelling and creative way. Please join us in raising your voice so that every child everywhere is vaccinated on time, every time. Let's be protected together. Vaccines work.
So what is the WHO trying to do to combat outbreaks worldwide?
Yeah, Secretary Tedros from Ethiopia, really a phenomenal new leader for the WHO, and has really looked at this as an equity thing, where the issues are really, does everybody have access to vaccines, and then does everybody have accurate information to act on that? And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of this misinformation in social media now has spread worldwide. And so we have many of these same issues with vaccine hesitancy starting to crop up everywhere in the world, including in places that continue to have these outbreaks. You know, when the decision was made to call vaccine hesitancy one of the top 10 threats to health this year in the WHO report, it was a serious decision, because what we've seen is that as attention gets directed to other things, you know, the Ebola outbreaks are a great example. After the Ebola outbreaks, as the health systems crumbled in some of those West African countries, the first thing that showed up was enormous measles outbreaks. And so as the public health infrastructure doesn't allow access to services and isn't providing vaccines, vaccine-preventable diseases are one of the first things that reemerge in those settings. And then you add in other areas with vaccine hesitancy, and it's just a perfect storm. And we were really worried that we're going to start to see more and more of these reemergent outbreaks, including then getting reintroduced into these areas where there are higher levels of vaccine-hesitant families.
Well, Dr. Conway, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kate. Good to see you.
Dr. James Conway is the Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also a pediatric disease specialist. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.